Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on our program, a new political force takes shape, Unite for Change, aiming to challenge the ANC and the DA in 2026. The rapid influx of Chinese car brands, how big a risk for the local auto sector? A 50 billion rand logistics hub outside Johannesburg promises to ease pressure on the N3, and South Africans are leaning more and more on credit. It's Tuesday, the 7th of October. The merger between the political parties GUD, BOSA and Rise Mzansi to form Unite for Change may shape South Africa's coalition landscape ahead of next year's local government elections. Now, supporters say it's about building a credible, values-driven alternative. Critics, though, are calling it a marriage of convenience. So let's get further into this issue. Brett Herron is with me from the Unite for Change Leadership Council, and he joins us to explain what's really behind this new political realignment. Brett, a very warm welcome to you. This merger, is it about shared values or simply pooling votes for survival?
It's Jeremy, it's really an outcome of the 2024 elections, which saw a fragmentation of votes across a number of political parties. We know that there were far too many political parties on the ballot. And during that election campaign, we participated as different parties in many debates and many discussions. And almost on every occasion, we were asked, why are you guys not together? You are saying the same things. And so it's a move beyond politics of personality, which seems to dominate South African politics, where we have a celebrity leader. And we are coming together to provide South Africans with a united alternative, which we hope will also expand. There are other parties that we expect to join us once their internal processes are completed. And it is driven by common shared values, similar policies, similar vision for South Africa, but also in response to this proliferation of political parties that I think voters are tired of.
Why has it taken so long?
It's complicated. These talks have taken, I have personally been engaged with talks in different constellations of political parties and players since 2019. We almost reached agreements before the 2024 elections, but it was just too close to the 2024 election to launch a new brand or a united brand. But it is complex because there are political structures that need to be consulted. There are supporters that need to be consulted. And you have to work out that you do have more in common than what you have that separates you.
How many other parties are you talking to? I know you're not going to tell me who they are, but is it a handful? Do you have a lot of people lining up to join this movement?
Well, before the announcement, we were talking to at least two parties who operate on a national scale and who are represented in the National Assembly. And then we're talking to many local parties that contest only in some municipalities. But since the announcement, all of us as the six leaders of this party, current leaders, have been inundated with approaches from local parties and from parties that are fairly well known in South Africa. So I think and I hope that in the coming weeks and months we will add some significant players to this, to Unite for Change.
How tricky is it going to be internally? Surely there's the danger of power struggles within the movement itself. How do you prevent that once the merger fully takes effect?
Well, we've been engaging for a long time, and one of the reasons why one of the parties has not joined us is around leadership. And how it's structured. We've agreed that our structure will be done on our leadership structure on an equitable basis. And I mean, so far we haven't had power struggles. We've obviously had differences of opinion, but we have on every occasion of meeting reached consensus. It may be naive to think that we will always reach consensus, but I think this idea that there needs to be a hierarchy of leadership in political parties is something that we're trying to move away from. If you ask any leader of most South African political parties, they derive their mandate for what they do and what they say from a collective leadership structure, whether it's like the executive, the federal executive of the DA, the NEC of the ANC. I mean, the leaders of those parties don't speak and do what they feel like doing. They do it based on a mandate, and we'll operate in the same way.
I understand that you parties are often run by collectives, but the reality is you do need a single leader at some point that becomes the face and the voice of the brand.
Well, we're not convinced that we need a single political celebrity face or leader in order to contest elections, especially the local government elections, where mayoral candidates will be the face of the campaign in each municipality and town. But we have committed to a leadership elective conference by December 2027. It will probably happen after the local government elections, not before. If this model works, then we will design the elective conference for 2027 using this model. Mm-hmm. If indeed the traditional model of having a leader and a chairperson and a secretary general or something equivalent is required, then we'll adapt.
How difficult, Brett, is it going to be to hold policy line on tough issues like land, jobs and corruption? You've already said that there has been some internal to-ing and fro-ing on big issues.
Yeah, and those are not the issues. I mean, I think that we've already established that there's close alignment on the issues that we want to campaign in the local government elections on. The manifesto is largely prepared, and we'll announce it soon. But we did hint at it at our announcement in terms of the five pillars that we wish to base our manifesto on, and we are in full alignment on those. And policy issues, you know, evolve. I mean, GOOD has been in existence for 5 years. Mm. We don't have a policy on every single issue that arises, and sometimes you have to go back to the drawing board as a team and develop a policy that you haven't yet developed. So I don't think that there's going to be a lot of difficulty. We've broadly discussed what could possibly be policy differences, and we are still working on those, but we found enough alignment to make the announcement on Sunday.
And just a quick answer, with MPs and councillors still under old banners, is it going to be difficult for voters to know what Unite for Change actually stands for right now at the end of 2025?
Yeah, so I mean, the law doesn't allow parties to merge. The South African electoral system doesn't allow political parties to merge without you losing your seats. So each of the parties will have to honor the mandates they received in the elections. Mm. In the case of GOOD, we contested in 2021, so we have 46 councillors across four provinces. And combined, we have MPs and MPLs. So we will have to serve out the terms of office both at local government level and provincial and national level. But we will start communicating on issues at local government level in anticipation of the 2026 local government elections under the banner of Unite for Change.
Brett Herron, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I'm sure you're aware that Chinese auto brands have surged in South Africa's new vehicle market, and local financiers like Westbank say they're not ducking the shift, they're embracing it. With returns rising and partnerships multiplying, what does this pivot from threat to opportunity mean for the future of vehicle finance? Well, I want to get a perspective on that. I'm in conversation now with Rob Gwerengwe, who's Chief Executive Officer of Westbank. And let's take a close look at those strategic implications. Rob, a very warm welcome. You've described, if I've got this correctly, Chinese brands as an opportunity in the sector and not a threat. What's driving that perspective?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy, and thanks for having me on your show. If we take a look at it, the Chinese imports present an opportunity mainly for our customers. So as Westbank, we are there to service the dealers as one part of the equation, as well as the end consumer. And if you consider the amount of pressure the consumer has been under. I mean, we know the stats, the debt to income in households over 60%, etc. The Chinese vehicles present an opportunity for customers to buy a vehicle that is of a high quality. I mean, they're coming out now with a 10-year, 1 million kilometer warranties, which is unheard of, and they have all the bells and whistles. In most cases, sort of half the price of what the competitor of traditional brands is doing. So for us, that's an opportunity. Our customers are warming up to the idea of the Chinese brands. I think there used to be a view that maybe Chinese brands are inferior in quality. That's starting to change. And we can see, I mean, when we talk about the opportunity, in 2016, Chinese imports sort of, they were about 0.3% of our total vehicle sales in South Africa. Year to date, 2025, it's 13.2%. So that's a significant jump. And the year-to-year trends, sort of double-digit growth for that. So I don't think that trend is stopping.
Where do you think this leaves the European marks? Are they on the back foot now?
I think it does represent a significant challenge for them. Again, if you look at the numbers, it's not like the market is growing. So in order for the Chinese importers to have growing sales, they're taking away from the traditional. So it is definitely a threat for the incumbents. And then there's some rethinking that needs to happen because, again, the GDP is not growing at that higher rate. So your customer base doesn't really shift. What then happens is you take customers from each other, which is where the Chinese importers are winning at the moment.
So this wave of new brands that is coming into the country, how is it affecting the vehicle financing landscape and more broadly credit appetite?
So as we learn more, I think we adjust our models. Up front, the challenge we had was not really understanding what would happen in the unfortunate event of a repossession, because that's part of the credit decision, whether or not we could get a decent value for those vehicles if ever we got to that point. And we're learning that the resale values on Chinese vehicles are as strong as the traditional brands. What we don't know yet is what happens when it's second, third, fourth owner, because the vehicles haven't been around for long enough. But for us, risk appetite remains pretty much the same. It just means for our consumers, affordability is a little bit better and they can afford more in terms of the overall tech and package that they get for the same price.
But it is putting the traditional auto sector under a lot of strain, particularly when it comes to manufacturing output, and that could have a domino effect on jobs, couldn't it?
Yeah, look, so, I mean, we were at Auto Week last week, and that was a big part of sort of proceedings and the conversation that was raised a few times. I was pleased with some of the responses from some of the Chinese importers saying that they are looking seriously at putting their manufacturing plants in South Africa, and they're speaking to the right people around it, because it does have an impact where local manufacturers, you know, that create jobs in South Africa and contribute a little bit more to the GDP, if they're under threat, it becomes a problem. So I think it's a problem we are well aware of. And our role, I guess, in the industry, beyond just serving dealers and customers, is to ensure that we contribute as much as we can to SA Inc. So that is a conversation we're part of, and we hope there's more manufacturing that moves this way.
Well, just leading on from that, the General Secretary of the National Union of Metal Workers, Ivan Jim, calling for what he termed decisive leadership and decision-making regarding the automotive sector. He went on to say that the sector is bleeding job losses, more retrenchments are imminent. If a big organization like yours is part of that conversation, what do you think needs to happen?
So it's a tricky one, and I mean, I leave that to the policymakers. But I think we need to have more incentives to have local manufacturing happen. I don't want to lose sight on the fact that, you know, there is value for clients that are really struggling to get out of these Chinese import vehicles. But I think there is a middle ground where I think the opportunity is for South Africa to become almost the hub of activity as these brands go deeper and deeper into the African continent. And that's where the opportunity lies, and have those jobs created here, but also have the value be delivered to our consumers and then consumers into the rest of the continent. Mr. Jim was very, very strong on that, very strong.
You make a very good point about this influx of brands potentially strengthening South Africa's position as an automotive hub for the continent. How realistic, though, do you think that really is?
I think it is very realistic. I think we have a lot of things going for us. I think we're one of the most mature automotive spaces on the continent. We have and have had many local manufacturers with the right incentives. So I think we have the ingredients. It's about making sure that we can have the right conversations, particularly with the Chinese importers, to get their manufacturing plants local. We have a couple new ones. I mean, Bike is opening in Kebega, as we speak. So I think it's not all doom and gloom. But there needs to be a lot of conversations quite quickly to make sure that we're on the front foot, because I don't think we'll be the only ones on the continent awake to this opportunity.
Yeah, of that there is absolutely no doubt, and certainly the automotive landscape in South Africa is shifting, and shifting very quickly. Rob Gwerengwe, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of WesBank. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A new white paper from the Port of Gauteng is proposing a 50 billion rand inland logistics hub, and that would relieve pressure, it says, on that busy N3 corridor between Durban and Johannesburg. It is one of the busiest but also most damaged highways in the country. It's a plan that promises to create something in the region of 50,000 jobs and also modernize how goods move across the economy. Let's get a little more on this. I'm in conversation now with Francois Norkeer, who's developer of the Port of Gauteng project. Francois, maybe let's just talk about why, first of all. How serious, in your words, is the current strain on that N3 freight corridor?
It's substantial, and rail is reduced drastically. Therefore, there's so much trucks on the N3. And the National Development Plan proposed a 50-50 split between trucks and freight. And at the moment, it stands at 14%. So something needs to be done that some of the goods can go onto rail and off the roads, so that holiday travelers can get to KwaZulu-Natal and family members can get together over Christmas and funerals and stuff like that.
Are you encouraged, to Francois, in any way by the seeming turnaround in Transnet and perhaps better rail volumes that it's reporting?
Not so much on the container corridor. It's battling. It's been losing billions every year. But Transnet is getting out of that corridor. It's going to be one of the corridors that's up basically for private sector operation. But it's losing so much that private sector operationals will not be able to pull it out of the debt and out of into profitability. So it needs some help. That's why we issued the white paper as to how the railway line basically can be helped, so that it can survive, because it will not survive just by private sector, Transnet walking away and handing it over to private sector.
So in simple terms then, this requires, if I'm hearing you correctly, a complete rethink of South Africa's logistics network. So in simple terms then, what does the Port of Gauteng project actually involve?
Okay, there's two things. There's the Port of Gauteng project, which is a 1,400-hectare inland port that will have a container terminal, a car terminal, and everything logistics at the entry point of Gauteng. But then there's the white paper deals with the corridor between Durban and Gauteng, how to get the logistics cost down and how to get the truck volume down and the train volume up. And it basically involves two things: performance-based trucks. It's a new form of trucking. It's very well established in Australia now. It's only getting traction in South Africa now. It needs to be fast-tracked. It basically will allow you to have longer and heavier trucks which are much safer and do less damage. And then the N3 toll concession is coming to an end in 2029. And a combination of moving that toll concession from a profit-based one that's making good money for Old Mutual and the PIC to a demand management and a cost recovery one, that some of those toll fees can subsidize the rail. And it's quite a long story how the PBS trucks will help getting more tolls that can go to the rail. But in 5 minutes, we won't be able to do that. But that's basically the crux, how you do it. It's a combination of the PBS trucks, which will pay much more tolls, and then taking that extra tolls and the profit on the tolls and subsidizing the rail.
And of course, you've got to pay for it. So where does the 50 billion rand come from? Is it public? Is it private? Or is it a partnership?
Private sector. Private sector. That is purely property developers, that end users, warehouse owners that will develop that. It's got nothing. The government must just do the framework, and the private sector will pay for the rest on the development of the inland port.
And what sort of interest so far, Francois?
Quite a bit of interest, yes. There's numerous of people looking around, but yeah, it will happen, because the moment you got the container terminal and a car terminal there, logistics is the growing property sector in the world. You know, in Pomona in California, there's a city called Pomona, just west or inland of Los Angeles. It's 20 kilometers by 10 kilometers, the city, and it's just warehousing. You know, Amazon is coming, Sheen is coming. The moment Timo is coming, they're flying their stuff in to ORT. Sooner or later, they'll be coming with containers via Durban Harbour. South African economy is tilting towards a lower cost, higher volume, lower margin business. You can see the car sales up 25% as we substituting expensive cars for cheaper cars. So that will just be purely driven by private sector. And if these stuff are implemented by government, which we requested, it will happen very quickly. There's a major demand for warehousing, especially large warehousing, which will be very cheap in the port of Gauteng because of the flat land. And the property development will all be private sector funded.
Are you confident that government will green light this in the time frames that you're talking about?
I hope so, because if they don't, then the container corridor will die. You know, it's Transnet has got 144 billion rands worth of debt. At least 24.4 billion of that debt is the container corridor in the last 13 years, which is lost between 1 billion and 3 billion rand a year. You add interest on interest. Transnet doesn't want that line anymore. So it needs help. And that's why we issued this white paper, and we've sent it off to all the departments involved. Gauteng Department of Roads already issued a statement that this fits into their plan. Mm. So I think that's the most important part. Now, you need a bit of buy-in from Mpumalanga, because the N3 goes for a short while through Mpumalanga. Then you need Free State. KwaZulu-Natal is in line with this PBS trucks. It's just, what is the government going to do with the N3 toll concession when it comes to an end in 2029? Maybe your guys must look into that. But if they don't, we will be stuck with the N3, which will be a truck highway, which will damage tourism in KwaZulu-Natal. We will lose the railway line and its infrastructure, because I can't see who's going to carry on those losses of billions of rand a year if something drastic is not being done.
And just a quick one, a promise of 50,000 jobs, where will those opportunities come from?
From that development. If you've got 1,400 hectares, that's basically a Wadeville and an L Road together. It will create a minimum of 50,000 jobs. Admin people doing the paperwork of all this logistics, packers, forklift drivers, security, route planners, truck drivers. That's where it will at least be 50,000. We just wanted to keep it conservative and not get up false hope.
Francois Norkia, thank you very much indeed, developer of the Port of Gauteng project.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's credit market, it seems, is on the move again. The latest TransUnion Industry Insights report for Q2 2025 shows a noticeable rebound in credit demand driven, I read, largely by millennials and Gen Z. Credit cards and vehicle loans are surging. Home loans are recovering as interest rates ease and overall delinquency levels are improving. So that's all good news. But behind the growth, I think there's a more complex story. It's probably one of stretched budgets, maybe tighter credit limits and rising subprime risk. So I want to talk about that with Aisha Hatia, who's Director of Research and Consulting at TransUnion. Aisha, a very warm welcome to you. So what's driving the overall rebound then?
Thanks, Jeremy. So we do see that, you know, it's mainly because of the lower interest rates. When interest rates drop, it does become cheaper for people to borrow money, so they feel more confident about taking on new loans. We also see a reached optimism coming from consumers, and that optimism also sort of heightens spend that we're seeing in the industry at the moment. So as you said, you know, that people are applying for things like credit cards, vehicle finance, and home loans, and these categories did see strong growth, you know, as well as, as some of the retail credit products as well, has also seen those growths.
Having said that, though, are South Africans using credit more strategically, or are we simply becoming more and more stretched?
There's definitely a component of both. So we are seeing consumers stretched. If you just look at the vehicle market as an example, you know, people are taking these loans with extended loan terms. So even though the installment might be a little bit less, they maintain these balances for a much longer time. And then it does pose a whole lot of additional risk for them in terms of the asset that's attached to that loan and managing the value of the loan versus the value of the asset. So there's definitely a combination of the two. I think the interesting thing we saw in the credit card space is how lenders are managing that inclusion. And in the credit card space, even though the numbers and the volumes are going up, the values are going down. So the actual value of the loan, the average loan amount has gone down by 20% year on year. So lenders are saying, we'll give access to credit, but we're going to manage our risk by managing that opening balance. So there's lots of tweaks and movements happening in the industry as well, but we are definitely stretching our consumers.
Two groups of those consumers are millennials and Gen Z, as I mentioned in the introduction. Why are they leading the growth? What's fueling their appetite?
I think millennials and as well as Gen Z, specifically in that credit card space, you know, they recognize the utility that comes with having the credit card specifically in their pocket. You know, now with all these online apps, Mr. D, your Uber, all of those things, they actually use that credit card for that utility. I think they're also acknowledging the fact that there are opportunities to leverage credit and also build your credit history and your credit records so that when it comes to getting your, you know, growing up into the more secured credit markets, they have sort of a reliable credit record that they can back up on.
So they've become a lot more responsible then?
Let's hope so.
Vehicle finance is booming. I also referenced that. Is this genuine confidence or maybe just a result of longer loan terms, which on the surface seem to make cars more affordable?
Again, we'll see there's a lot of measures in place here. So if we compare to the overall sales we're seeing from NAMSA, the vehicle sales has also increased year on year, particularly new car sales. You know, we do see a sort of surge in more affordable models coming from the Chinese market. And what's that happening is also causing a shift between used and new cars. So before, when consumers were sort of, you know, skewed towards used, they're now saying, like, look, if I buy a new car, I probably spend a little bit more than I did for a used car. But with the new car, I get a better interest rate. I can get a longer term and most likely also a bigger balloon payment. So my affordability, my month to month, doesn't necessarily change. So it's definitely the consumers also leveraging that interplay between the current market that we're seeing in the VAF broader market, just not just the loans, but also the vehicle sales as well.
But it's that balloon payment that can pop and really hurt you at the end of the term.
100%. So it's really understanding the risk that comes with that and being able to maintain the value of the asset, as I said earlier on. So again, there's a lot to consider from a consumer perspective, you know, whether they're thinking short-term affordability versus long-term sustainability. And that's where the resilience and understanding, you know, all these sort of levers that need to be managed through the life cycle of the loan.
And Aisha, home loan growth is back. Again, I'm assuming that it's obviously interest rate linked, but delinquencies have also ticked up. There's a tension there, isn't there?
Yes, there is. So while more people are getting home loans, the repayment stress is still a concern. So the share of home loans that were 3 months or more overdue has increased by 7.5%. And it does mean that some households are struggling with affordability. So even though that the interest rates have come down, for banks and for lenders, the challenge is to encourage new lending while keeping a close eye on those who might be showing early signs of difficulty. If you look at the interest rates, you know, the drops, yes, it did offer some relief, but again, it was relief that consumers needed quite urgently, you know, for other emerging sort of stress that they had. So if you consider over the last 5 interest rate drops, if you had a home loan of $1 million and you had a car about 440K, that's 900 Rand extra in your wallet. And that's besides food inflation, you know, other costs, that petrol inflation, all of those other things that you had to sort of buff with that 900. And so unfortunately, we're still seeing that stress in the home loan space from a delinquency perspective.
And on a broader canvas, what do these trends tell us about consumer resilience heading into next year?
So our consumers, you know, they have showed that renewed growth and resilience, again, thanks to that interest rate and improving consumer confidence. Again, our younger generations, particularly millennials and Gen Zs, are driving much of those growth, specifically in the credit card and in the vehicle finance space. However, you know, while more people are gaining access to credit, that affordability measures and repayment risks continue to remain, especially, like we're saying, in that home loan market and among those higher risk borrowers, continues to remain a concern. So we see that optimism, but we need to make sure that consumers are completely aware of their pockets, of their wallets, you know, keeping track of their expenditure, keeping track of their lending, and ensure that they continue to expand, but in a more responsible way.
So what do you think lenders will be watching most closely over the next couple of quarters? It'll be a combination, I imagine, of probably risk, demand and affordability.
100%. And, you know, I think if you look at the current strategy around the lower balances, it's something that the retailers do really well in terms of a low to grow strategy, where they'll start the consumer off with a very small balance, give them an opportunity to build that behaviors and repayment behaviors to avoid delinquencies, and then give them an opportunity to expand into more mature products with higher balances. So it's a good strategy for lenders to start off and allow the consumer to grow versus, you know, bombard them at a high risk and high balances up front.
Aisha Hatia, thank you very much indeed, Director of Research and Consulting at TransUnion Africa. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.